Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you quickly about one of our sponsors, which is MasterClass. And here's the deal with MasterClass. It's classes online taught by masters, taught by people who are at the absolute top of their field. Dustin Hoffman will teach you acting. Serena Williams will teach you tennis. Coming soon, they got Christina Aguilera teaching you singing. Annie Leibovitz teaching photography. Usher is going to teach performance. But there's also a writer on there, James Patterson. And you know James Patterson because James Patterson's last 19 books have been bestsellers. In this masterclass, which costs just $90, you get his whole process, everything from outlining to marketing your book. So go check it out. Go to masterclass.com/longform. That's masterclass.com/longform. And you'll enjoy it. Okay, here's the show. Hello. Welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hey, it's good to be here with you.
Yeah.
It's really nice to be here with you guys.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
Who's on the show? This is an active day. I believe two episodes were taped today. So it's a big day in the podcast.
Huge day.
Huge day.
Huge day. My guest this week is Jasmine Hughes. Jasmine is a associate editor at the New York Times Magazine. Before that, she was at the Hairpin. She's also a essayist. She writes essays. They are funny. She writes things on Twitter that are funny. She makes me laugh because she's funny. And so I had her on because she's funny.
Wow. And brilliant and very interesting person.
She's a super interesting person. She's very young and she's been very successful in her short time in the media world, and she had a lot to say about both those things.
What about sponsors this week?
Well, of course, there's MailChimp. Over 8 million businesses rely on it for their email newsletter needs. If yours does not, I don't know why you've made that decision. I suggest you amend it. If you are already using MailChimp, you know how easy to use, yet so powerful it really can be. Max and I use it for long form. Evan uses it for the Atavist.
True.
Probably almost every guest who is part of a major publication who's been on the show, that publication uses MailChimp. Let's do this, MailChimp.
Now here's Max with Jasmine Hughes.
Jasmine Hughes.
Max Linsky.
Jasmine Hughes. Jasmine Hughes, is very nice to have you here.
Thank you.
I'm enthused about your presence.
I am very excited and sweaty.
It's warm in here now, and it's only going to get warmer.
And I'm on the Long Form Podcast.
You were on the Long Form Podcast.
And I'm very excited, which makes me very, very sweaty. My first day at the New York Times is schwitzing.
That's not the only bodily fluid story from your first day at the New York Times.
My first day at the Times. Let's jump right into my menstrual history, Max.
Let's just get there.
I've been praying that you ask me this.
We have set a new record for quickest time to menstrual history on the Long Form Podcast.
Okay, so now it's like a well-trod story. But on my first day at the New York Times, after going off of birth control 21 days prior, I got the worst period of my life, and I bled through my pants onto a white chair during my orientation. And then the worst part is that I had to come back the next day. So I was in orientation and I was learning about like corporate benefits and I could feel it. You know, sometimes when you're a woman, you know, like a good melon. And I knew that like there was just blood everywhere. So I very calmly excused myself and went to the bathroom, not before sneaking a peek of the fucking Jackson Pollock painting that I'd left on my seat. And then I did something really smart and something I'm really proud of, which is that I somehow cleaned it up with my butt. And yeah. And Dean Bacay didn't know. That's the best, right? I just don't want Dean to find out.
But Dean knows now because you wrote about it.
And then I wrote about it for the world. So maybe.
Okay. That story brings up a lot of emotions in me. I feel...
Do you have a period story that you want to share too?
It's like a melon. It's like a good melon.
It's like a good melon.
No, I don't have a good period story for you. I hearing you tell that story is like watching an episode of like Curb Your Enthusiasm. I hurt inside. First of all, that story is hilarious.
Thank you.
Second of all, it is brave. It's a brave thing to write about, I would say. Maybe most people's instincts would be to like... never talk about that. Keep that one to themselves. I'm interested in that thing that you do, which is take something like that and write about it. But I think maybe we could just start one step back, which is, if you wouldn't mind, just defining what imposter syndrome is for our listeners.
So imposter syndrome is a state in which a high achieving or just like a regular achieving person has a lot of difficulty in accepting their achievements. So generally they chalk it up to luck or some sort of deceit, or basically just feel like a fraud the entire time.
Did you feel like a fraud on your first day at the New York Times?
No, I felt bloody on my first day at the New York Times. I felt like a fraud ever since the New York Times, you know, the entire entity got together, emailed me and asked me to apply to the job. They asked me to apply. I started working at the Times in April of this year, and they emailed me in January, because that's how long it fucking takes to, like, get a job there. And the entire time I thought it was, like, a fun joke that I was like, here's little me, like, applying for this job, la, la, la. I mean, to be totally honest and, like, sort of shitty about it, I thought it was total tokenism and that they wanted to talk to me because I was, like, a young, cool black person. And at some point, they were going to pull the rug out beneath me and say, like, you're not what we're looking for. And then, I don't know, I'd have a fun story for my grandkids. I almost got a job this one time.
But that wasn't what it was.
But that's not what happened. And then I got the job, and then I was really scared.
What were you scared of?
Ugh. Everything. At the time, I was working at this lovely website called The Hairpin, and my immediate reaction was, I don't want to leave The Hairpin. And then it was sort of like, oh, fuck, I think I have to do this. And then it was immediately, I'm not smart enough to do this. So I had like 2 weeks between when I accepted and when I started, and I kept like hoping that I would wake up with like a higher IQ and like a degree from Harvard.
Like, all since you'd been offered the job, you would just be the person who would have gotten the job.
Right. Like, some at some point I was just expecting that transformation to land. And then I started, and I was totally myself. I was like extra myself. I had enough of myself to go around and leave behind on a chair.
I think part of the reason I wanted to talk to you about the imposter syndrome thing, you've written about it a bunch, and it's interesting. I was looking at The Hairpin earlier, and your story on imposter syndrome is like the number two story still on the website. It's a thing that connects with people. You have been in situations that you maybe shouldn't have been in for a very long time. You skipped two grades.
I graduated 2 years early. That's accurate. I graduated from college when I was 20, because I graduated from high school when I was 16, because I was homeschooled, which explains a lot. I'm still recovering. I was homeschooled until I was in fifth grade, and I was 8 turning 9, and they just like let me into public school. So since I was in the fifth grade, I've just sort of been in a situation in which I didn't feel totally prepared.
Did you have imposter syndrome when you were in high school and college?
When I was in high school and I was in college, I thought I was hot shit. I thought I was super cool, and nobody could tell me anything. And like, to paint the picture, I was like 75 pounds. I had glasses and braces, and like always dressed like I was prepared for a flood, which means like my jeans were always like way above my ankles and like not in a cool way. But I always had boyfriends, and I always had a squad of like two slightly nerdier girls who just followed me around.
To make sure that you were insulated.
To make sure that I had a pad or a tampon with me whenever I needed one. Yeah.
Oh, I'm gonna fall into a lot of menstrual traps.
Here we go.
In this conversation, am I not?
Let's go. No, in fifth grade, I remember telling my best friend to tie my shoes for me. She listened to me, and that was the first time I was like, I might have something here. I don't know what that is, like power and influence and also just like shittiness and friends with no backbone. But it was a turning point for me.
We have a lot of young people who listen to the show, and I would be interested in what your advice is for overcoming that imposter syndrome.
So would I, because I would apply it to myself. I don't have any advice. I'm the oldest of five girls, so I always tell people what to do, but I never know what I'm talking about. But I say it in such a way that it's just like, that sounds like it makes a lot of sense. And it sounds so stupid, because this is what everyone has ever told me, who I look up to. And I'm like, oh, you possibly can't have imposter syndrome. Ta-Nehisi Coates, you're Ta-Nehisi Coates. You just have to deal with it. Like, it's not easy. So, all right, when I say that in order to get over imposter syndrome, you have to deal with it, like, I realize that it takes time. Like, now that I've been at the Times for 6 months, I can sort of say, like, I am dealing with it. When I was at the Times for 2 months, I was going to therapy for the first time in like, 6 months. I love therapy because I love to talk about myself. And I was, like, crying in the bathroom a lot.
Why?
Because I felt so dumb. I felt, like, not even stupid. I felt totally inept. Like, everyone had made a poor choice in bringing me there, myself included.
You felt inept in the work?
It's weird. So, like, everyone at the New York Times, unsurprisingly, is at the top of their game. And has had, like, internships at Harper's and, like, worked at Rolling Stone when it was Rolling Stone and worked at the Village Voice when it was the Village Voice. And is just, like, effortlessly smart and brilliant and attractive.
But you know some of them are crying in the bathroom, right?
But it's so hard to believe when, like, okay, you can cry in the bathroom and then you come back and do your work. And it's a lot different when your work is like, not to denigrate tweets because I love Twitter, but when you come back from the bathroom crying and you work on like crafting some tweets versus when you come back and work on a cover story, those story editors or whatever editors who were crying in the bathroom, like no one would have given them their jobs if they weren't capable, which I know applies to me too, but it was myself. So I got it all fucked up. At least I know, with the help of psychotherapy.
You starting to get some confidence?
No. But what I am starting to do is, like, feel more comfortable in saying, hey, I'm really uncomfortable. Because before it was almost definitely, it was embarrassing. There weren't so many people I could talk to about it because I didn't know a lot of people at the Times very well. So now I have these support systems in place where I can go to, like, one of my coworkers and talk to them about something and we'll have a conversation. And with my friends, too, it's getting better. But it's, like, sort of fucking embarrassing when you're 23 years old and your biggest problem in the world is, like, you have a job at the New York Times. You know what I mean? And so this is why I carry around so much, like, guilt and, I don't know, and stress and whatever about my job. Because it's, like, what do I have to complain about? And yet, It's not that I complain about the work. I just, like, I feel so undeserving all the time. Not even just of this job, but of, like, a lot of the opportunities I've been afforded. And, I mean, now I'm getting to the point where I can say, Jasmine, you work very hard. And, like, maybe you deserve, like, 25% of the things that you have done. And one day it'll be 26%, and one day it'll be, like, 50. But I don't think I'll ever get to the point where I'm, like, where I totally believe in myself and think that I deserve everything I have, which is good, because then you get comfortable, and then you get lazy, and then you're just, like, a dude-iter.
Are there role models for people who have gotten over, like, that 50% threshold, but, like, keep kicking ass?
No one that I know. Maybe Jenna Weiss-Berman. She's going to take that out.
Definitely.
Jenna Weiss-Berman knows that she's hot shit, and she is hot shit.
Yeah, she might also leave that in.
I hope she does. I don't care what she does.
I feel like you just talked me back into imposter syndrome. Like, I feel like you have written about this thing really kind of eloquently and beautifully, and it seems like it's still very, very present for you. So the answer is basically it just doesn't go away.
No, I don't think it ever goes away. And a lot of people have told me that, and it's really frustrating to hear. You hope that, like, one day when you're the fucking editor-in-chief of blah, 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 that you'll wake up and be like, okay, I deserve my job. But so far, I haven't met anyone who's told me they feel that way. But I will say I don't talk to white men a lot.
I don't feel that way.
You don't feel that way?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, like, part of the reason I'm so interested in it, like, if you listen to the show at all, it's very clear that I feel that way all the time. And I'm completely incapable of not saying it out loud.
You know how much I listen to the show. Yeah, I mean, like, so much of imposter syndrome focuses on, like, how can I feel okay while I'm still in the process of making it? Like, when I'm in my first entry-level job, when I'm trying to get my first clips, like, my first bylines, yada yada. But no one, or at least not to me, no one really publicly talks about, like, how to fight imposter syndrome when you've already made it, and like all signals point to like you should be super happy and you should feel great all the time, and you're still just like, I don't think I should be here. This is a terrible mistake. I'm always really reluctant to talk about this because I don't want anyone to think I'm on this pity tour. Like, come to me and tell me how great I am. Like, I'm great, and I know I'm great, but there are just certain things that I cannot overcome. And the reason why I write about them is because I know other people are feeling this way too. So I don't write that often, but every time I write about imposter syndrome, which has been a grand total of 2 times, people email me, and I always feel so hugely flattered.
Part of the reason that it resonates with people too is like the last time you wrote about it was this thing for Cosmo.
Yeah.
Where you dressed up like a Cookie from Empire.
Cookie Lion.
You went to the New York Times every day for a week wearing like leopard skin pants and white jumpsuits and looking fantastic.
Thank you.
Looking great.
I did. I meant to find out the difference between leopard print and cheetah print that week, and I never did. Do you know the difference?
Definitely not.
They're very close.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's something.
That piece was like, it was about this feeling, right? Which I know that you are particularly young for your job.
Mm-hmm.
But my assumption is that most people on their first day or their first week or their first month or their first year at the New York Times feel pretty weird, unless they're kind of an asshole.
Unless they're an asshole. And you know, I'm sure there are assholes.
There are definitely some people who are like, hell yeah, I'm here, obviously. But most people probably go through that. And mm-hmm. part of the thing I'm interested in about you is maybe they go talk to their therapist about it, or maybe they like write about it in their journal. Maybe they talk to their partner about it, their friends. You, Jasmine Hughes, write an essay for Cosmo where you dress up like Cookie.
Yeah.
Which is funny as shit. But also, like, involves putting yourself out there in a way that I find really interesting.
That's not a question, but it was a lot of, like, cool compliments to me, so thank you.
Do you want a question?
No. I'm going to respond to it. I did all of those things. I talked to my partner. I talked to my therapist a lot. I talked to my friends. But I don't find a lot of value in keeping things private. So I was on a panel earlier this week talking about feminism and media, and we had to answer the question of whether or not we were feminist writers. And I said I was, mostly because I don't write that much and because I wanted to make like a cheap joke, but also because like when I do write, my first MO is to make people laugh. Like that's super obvious. And my second MO is to make women feel better, and specifically women. I've been blessed with no chill, so I'm going to use that for the best. And if I bleed all over myself, then I'm going to tell people about it, because the person who bleeds all over herself and she's super embarrassed is going to feel slightly better the next time it happens.
Why don't you write more?
That's a really good question. I have not ever written anything for the New York Times, which is weird. Because it's scary, right? So when I took the job at the Times, I had been writing at the Hairpin every day. And I told myself that I wanted to focus on being a better editor. And I was going to stop writing because blogging takes up so much of your brain. I wanted to be a better editor because I didn't think I was a great editor, and I still am not sure if I'm a good editor, and that's what I'm working towards.
I don't feel like you really answered the question.
I'm not really answering the question. Why don't I write more?
I've got 4 pieces down here to talk to you about.
Okay.
They're all like personal essays, I'd say.
Yeah.
That you've written over the last maybe year and a half.
Probably.
I guess I'm wondering why at 23... you decided to take a job where you're working on other people's writing rather than spending your days working on your own.
I mean, I think Jill Abramson used to say, like, the Times is always the prettiest girl in the room. So it's sort of, it very much matters what you want to do, but in a way you're sort of just like so shell-shocked that like the homecoming king is looking at you. You're just like, I'll do anything you want. I don't know if I want to be a writer. I guess that's the real question. So
that's what I'm asking.
I write when I feel like I have something to write about. I don't think I would be a good, like, daily grind writer. I write when something, like, dumb happens to me.
That sounds kind of luxurious.
Yeah.
But it also sounds a little safe to me. It's a little safe to only write when you're sure it's going to kill.
Well, when I wrote at the Hairpin, I wrote every day.
That's a different kind of writing.
Are you denigrating blogging right now, the highest form of American journalism? Yeah, you're totally right. I'm not a very fast writer, which means I wouldn't be good at writing more often. And I don't know. So far, I've been lucky to only have to write about things that really interest me. It turns out I don't like a lot of things. So that's really it. I don't know if I could, like, write at the Times every day.
Hey, a quick word from our sponsor, The Great Courses. If you've been listening to the show, then you have some sense of what The Great Courses is. It's like a, how can I describe it? It's like a online wonderland of learning. There's thousands of courses taught by award-winning college professors, and you can watch them anywhere you want. TV, laptop, phone, whatever. It all works. The individual courses, they cost like $200 to $300 a piece, but The Great Courses, they've got a new product out. It's called The Great Courses Plus, and what it lets you do is take an unlimited number of courses for one low monthly price. Thousands and thousands of courses. You can take it and just take that knowledge, put it right in your brain. History, science, photography, cooking, whatever you're interested in, they've got a course on the topic, and you can take as many of them as you want with The Great Courses Plus. And here's the thing. If you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/longform, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/longform, your first month will be free. Unlimited knowledge for free. Pretty good deal. Thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show. Let's get back to Jasmine.
So when you think like way down the line, deep into the future.
Right.
When you're 30.
When I'm 30.
Whew.
And I look like you.
I'm way older than that. What do you imagine yourself doing? Do you see yourself editing? Do you see yourself like running for national office? Do you see yourself writing every day in like a room by yourself?
I knew you were going to ask me this question, and I still don't have an answer. I think I want to be a story editor. I don't even want to say that. I don't know. I mean, part of me still wants to be at the New York Times because that would be dope, right? Part of me wants to be at the New York Times when I'm 30 because it would mean that I never got fired for, like, tweeting a dumb thing, which seems possible every single day. Part of me wants to be an editor. Part of me wants to, I don't know, have, like, written a book and realize that writing dumb stuff is my calling and I can do it really easily and really quickly. And I would just do it. And then part of me wants to do something, like, totally out of left field, which is not that far out of left field, and, like, write for TV or something. That being said, I have a really long time before I turn 30.
You could probably do all those things.
I could probably do all those things.
Do you think of yourself as an ambitious person?
Yes. Yeah. I'm an ambitious person, and I think it is to the detriment of my personal life. A little bit. I'm also a really fast texter, so it's, like, easy to keep in touch with people.
I think the first thing of yours that I read that, like, made me sit up in my chair was you wrote this piece for TNR about, like, white people making white people jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's the bane of my existence.
White people making white people jokes.
White people.
Full stop. It was great, and it was really funny, and it was smart, and, you know, white people should feel shame. And
about everything?
About all the time.
About everything.
And they did. Plus, it was at TNR, so it was like you were like shaming white people in their own pages.
In their own house.
Yeah, you walked into the foyer.
Yeah.
And shamed them in their own house.
Bam.
Tell me about that piece and where it came from, and also like what the reaction to it was and what it was like for you to put that out there. I mean, like I said, it was funny, but it was fucking strong.
Thank you. That piece came to me from James Burnett, who's not at TNR anymore. Yeah, at this point, I'd written A Shouts and Murmurs, so I was like, I'm an authority on comedy and humor. Ask me anything.
Reading back through bullshit. Your stuff, I gotta just tell you, there's like this brief period right around then when you're describing yourself as a humorist.
I know, right? Because I wrote that one Shouts and Murmurs. It was a fucking lie.
That's also just not...
That's like not a thing.
It's not cool either.
It's not like a cool... I don't know. I thought it was cool in my youth.
Sure.
I've grown
sure.
So much
back,
since then.
Back in 2014.
Back in January when that piece came out.
Jesus.
Yeah. So the piece was... James and I went to coffee and we were just talking about things that are noticed on the internet. And as I am always irked by white people, love them as I do, I just noticed this like cool new trend where white people were making fun of themselves, which is fine, but they were doing it under the guise of like sort of racial unity. of trying to show people of color that, like, white people are bad and I know it, but, like, I'm one of the cool ones. Like, I'm not a regular white person, I'm a cool white person. And it blew my mind. So I wrote this thing just being like, if you are a white person and you want to make fun of white people, like, that's fine, but you're not helping anyone. You're actually just reinforcing the privileges that you have that people of color already know about and we feel shitty about. So, like, don't.
I appreciated it that part of your, like, critique was you're ruining the joke. Mm-hmm. Like, the joke's not funny.
It's not funny when, like, Max Linsky, if you were to say something, like, okay, what'd you think? I'm in a hilarious person. So if I were to say something about your shirt right now, so it looks like something that was used to scrub the floors of the worst L.L. Bean in America. I can say that, and that's fine. But if you start talking about how, like, oh, I'm a white guy and I love L.L. Bean and fucking Starbucks and Louis C.K., I'd be like, not only are you boring and unrefined, but, like, that's not doing anything for me.
This is a nice shirt.
It's an okay shirt. So I had only written one thing on the subject of race before, which is this, like, Jezebel piece about being a black person, being a black woman and having a white boyfriend and how, like, that was still a big deal to people.
That was, like, the first big piece you wrote.
That was the first thing I ever wrote. But it was on Jezebel. And there's a certain community there, which, and they were largely positive, which was nice. TNR opened me up to, like, angry white adults, which don't always read Jezebel. People are really mean, and I got really scared. Like, I got some Facebook messages from women who, like, from a woman who, her profile picture was, like, of her two grandchildren, and what I could see was that she was, like, this sort of innocuous-seeming, like, docile old woman living in the South, but, like, sent me the most explicative-laden Facebook message that, like, told me to go back to Africa. And I was like, what are you talking about? Someone called me a racist N-word. And I was like, that's, like, inherent. That's not a thing.
Right.
Like, that can't be a thing.
Is there something, like, worse than oxymoron?
Than, like, a bad oxymoron? Yeah. And that was really rough. But I really like the piece, and I still stand by it.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
One thing I'm interested in is what your feelings are on the, like, personal essay economy. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a occasionally, like, derided kind of writing on the internet.
Yeah, totally.
And also, it's historically a thing that people don't really pay for.
Yeah.
And so I'm interested, as someone who has predominantly written that kind of stuff and also commissioned a bunch of stuff that maybe didn't get paid for that much at the Hairpin, do you think that's bullshit? Like, do you think that people getting paid nothing for it is bullshit? Do you think that the knock that it is kind of, like, easy or cheap is bullshit?
I think it's bullshit when people denigrate the personal, or sort of, like, simplify the personal essay economy and make it this, like, tremendous sob story in which these, like, horrible hardline editors who are obsessed with clicks and obsessed with dicks are, like, attacking these poor writers and, like, forcing them to mine their personal lives for these, like, incredible, like, clickbaity pieces of gold. Because that's not what happens. As a person who writes personal essays all the time, like, more often than not, people do it because they want to. It's, like, it's so simple, I feel stupid saying it, but they have a story to tell, not because they want $300, you know? So it's been a conversation on the internet a lot, and it's sort of maddening because, like, number one, just because there's a ton of something doesn't mean it's bad. It just means there's more bad stuff out there, which is true of, like, war journalism and political coverage. Like, just shit is bad sometimes. And secondly, I just, like, where does the power really lie? Like, I've never been in a situation in which, like, I've encountered a traffic-hungry editor who's, like, gone into, you know, like, some sort of message board in which people are trying to, like, recover from something and been like, you have a story to tell. Bring it to blah, blah, blah website, and I'll give you so much exposure. You know, that's not how it happens. It happens when people pitch us. At least in my time being an editor, very rarely have I told people, like, you should write that, which means I should probably be a better editor. So at least when I worked at The Hairpin, which is a site for ladies, a site for weird girls is, I think, how it was sold, we'd get, like, 80 pitches a week.
And you mostly, like, commission stories out of those pitches.
Yeah. When I was at The Hairpin, two people worked at The Hairpin. So we'd do some light blogging, and we'd write the occasional longer thing when we felt like it, but we were like going through submissions and editing like 6 to 12 pieces at a time and taking care of tweets and making sure people were being paid. Like, we weren't doing the bulk of the work there. All of that work came from freelancers, many of whom like blind pitched us just because they were like, here is a venue in which I can tell the story I want to tell. And then like, that's how it works, right?
Sure.
Like, we didn't have a stable of like really sad girls who, I don't know, had a belly button infection and then want to write about it.
Was it hard for you to not pay people very much money to tell those stories?
Well, what are we defining as very much money?
That's a good question.
Well, when I was at the Hairpin and things changed, we paid people a sliding scale. Like, if you did something really huge, if you did like a deep investigative story, which not a ton of people did, to be honest, we would probably give you somewhere in the $200 to $300 range. Most of our writers got between like $125 to $200 for a post. Obviously, that varied depending on like what the piece was.
Yeah, that's not that much money.
That's not that much money, no. But I also don't think that people write for the Hairpin and they use it to support themselves.
What do you guys pay at the Times?
$500.
$500 for a piece, no matter what the like length or
for
scope
a web
is.
Piece, yeah, yeah. $500.
No matter what it is.
Across the board. So it's one thing, yeah, like $125 isn't a ton of money, but it's one thing to get $125 from like a small niche publication that you know is run by two people and is sort of like strung together with sticks in the most beautiful way. And it's another thing to get paid $125 from like a huge media corporation.
All right, I got some other things I want to talk to you about.
Okay,
we've talked a little bit about your youth and your courage, your verve. We've talked a little bit about the writing you do, and we've talked a little bit about the editing that you do. But you have this other thing. You started this site called Writers of Color, which is basically a database of writers of color, which I think is there to sort of serve as this constant reminder to editors that there are writers of color and they cannot make the excuse that there are not people to assign these stories to.
Right, because I just gave you 700 of them.
Once you put that site up and you did it with some friends and you were telling me earlier that it's you don't feel like you have the time to keep it going, but tell me about when you guys announced that thing and you started asking for people to come to you. Like, were you surprised by the response? Was it heartening?
It was both heartening and sort of heartbreaking that, like, a total goober like myself could be at brunch and come up with this seemingly, like, hugely obvious idea and have it fill such an obvious hole in the industry. Like, it was really, really great, and we immediately got a flood of submissions and a lot of interest from editors and stuff, too. But it, in some ways, made me really sad that, like, it took me. I don't think that's a hugely novel idea to, like, have a list of writers of color or to even just to, like, try to get more writers of color in your newsroom and in your publication. But for some reason, in 2015, in Obama's America, it's still like why didn't I think of that to so many people?
Did it make you optimistic about the sort of like racial dynamics in media changing? Do you feel more optimistic about that than you did before?
I feel only slightly optimistic because it's really great, right, that all these writers of color will hopefully start getting these assignments and jobs because of the database that my friends and I created. But I want more than that. It's really easy to take a group of marginalized people and to go back to the nightmare of the personal essay economy, to like use them for their experiences and then like pump up your site with all these like quote unquote diverse stories, and then you sort of just throw them away. So while I think it's really great that like through the Writers of Color site, people have gotten to write these personal essays or write takes on some of like the horrifying racialized violence that's been going on, I want those people to write about like financial stories and write about politics and write about the election and not just write about like what they are presumed to know because of the way they look.
I'm interested in how you think this changes on a practical level, right? So part of what I think people responded to at that Writers of Color site was exactly what you're saying. Like, it was just a simple idea. It's kind of surprising it wasn't there before.
Yeah.
And it's actually helpful. It's both like a kind of like a monument, but also something that has like a functional purpose?
There were a couple of sites that were doing the same purpose, but the fact that so many people reacted to it, like, I was very proud, but I also felt really stupid. Partially because I like didn't think about it before, because I've been complaining about this for a long time.
Sure, okay. But like, so it's got this functional purpose and it's got this like symbolic purpose.
Yeah.
In a functional way, how does this change?
Personally, I try not to assign stuff to white dudes. Because, okay, when I had the idea to make the site, I was still working at the Hairpin. So again, like, most of the stuff coming in was through submissions, and most of those submissions were from white women, but Haley and I worked very hard to, like, reach out to people of color. We got a bunch of people of color writing. It was super great. Then we created the site, and I was, like, so angry at all of, like, the evil, lazy editors who weren't, like, looking out for people beyond, this, like, the circle of writers that they already knew. And then I got a job at the Times, and, you know, we're tethered to a news cycle, and, like, the editors above me and myself to some degree, like, want a certain, like, a writer with, like, X number of bylines elsewhere so you can sort of verify their talent and da-da-da-da. And I could feel myself, like, slipping back into, like, oh, well, I know that this white dude has written this thing for, like, this predominantly white publication. Why don't I just call him? And then having this project right in front of my face is like, no, dummy. Like, this is the thing that you were trying to fight against. It's just very easy, like, especially in New York media, which is so, like, lovely and also really fucking evil and insidious, to just, like, call on the people you know. So at least for me, in being an editor, it's pushed me, having the Writers of Color project has pushed me to, like, just not rely on the people that I know.
How do you feel about the fact that your boss at the New York Times Magazine is a white dude, and his boss is a white dude, and his boss is a white dude?
But then his boss is a black dude.
True.
This is the first time I've ever worked for a man, which I feel very, like, sort of blessed to say, like, I've gone this far. Like, it's a little challenging, right? To, like, on the weekend, I'll, like, hang out with all my black girlfriends, and we'll talk about, you know, we'll plan, because it's actually going to happen, like, how we're going to take over and be in charge of everything in the near future, and then go into the office, and it's just, like, fucking, like, button-down shirts and cords and loafers and, like, 5 o'clock shadow, and it's the New York Times. And it's not disheartening. What it is just motivating. I mean, what's great about the people that, like, the white dudes at the Times, I think they're all lovely. And the white dudes at the All were mostly lovely. And I've been lucky, at least when I've had to work with a bunch of white dudes, I've been working with good white dudes. But even still, I tend to gravitate towards the people who aren't white dudes. And that doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Being someone who's as invested in changing this industry as you appear to be, working for a very, very prominent magazine that is clearly making an effort to try and bring in voices that historically have not been in the magazine. And yet, it's still like a bunch of white dudes at the top.
Okay, so when I got the job and before I started, I went away to the Rockaways just to, like, I went by myself for 3 days just to, like, clear my head and eat a lot. And when I was gone, the cover story that Rachel Consiganza had written on Toni Morrison came out. And I had, like, such a bevy of emotions that week. I was, like, really sad to leave the Hairpin. And then I was really excited to work at the New York Times and, like, call my parents and say that I was working at the New York Times. And then I was super terrified. And then I was like, I'm going to work with all these white people. Like, what's going to happen? And then this, like, huge, fucking beautiful cover story on Toni Morrison comes out, written by, like, one of my favorite black female writers, and then I, like, immediately felt better. It wasn't like I had no doubt, but it's been, I don't know, it's been really obvious that, like, the Times is trying to do better, and the magazine especially is trying to do better. I think what's different now, like, both at the Times and largely in media in general, is that the white dudes know that they're white dudes running the place. The tiny bit of recognition in some sort of way is hugely optimistic to me. Once you stop thinking that you're the default and you start thinking yourself, you start labeling yourself in a way that you label other people, that's what incites change.
It sounds optimistic.
Yeah, so I am optimistic.
If a woman of color called you tomorrow and said, I would love for you to come work on my less prominent magazine, and you would have a very similar role, would you do that?
No, because I really like my job and because I've had a lot of jobs and I should stay in one place for a while. And as much as the Times has to give to me, like, I have a lot to give to them too, and they haven't gotten a lot of it yet, and they're paying me a nice amount of money, and I'd like to, like, give it up.
All right. How do you feel about where you're at compared to most people your age? Is that a tricky thing? Like, most people who are 24 are, like, fucking around trying to figure some shit out.
Mm-hmm.
And you are going to work at the New York Times.
Yeah. I feel really guilty about it. On one hand, I feel sort of like, oh, I'm doing a good job. I have two retirement accounts. Like, I'm fucking crushing it right now. But on the other hand, sometimes I get, like, I get very intense fears that I'm not doing it right. I don't feel like I have struggled enough in a way. And I feel like I've never had a service job, which is sort of like my deepest, darkest secret, that when people are 24, sometimes they work in service and they work in retail. And, like, that's really great because, you know, everyone says that you should work a service job because you know how to treat people. I've caught myself doing that shitty thing that, like, that Harvard's kids do when they say, oh, I go to school in Cambridge, not Tufts, just like a school, you know. Sometimes I'd help you by working a magazine and then don't tell them anything else.
And then they're like, which magazine?
And I'm like, oh, yeah, like the New York Times. Because it also means something. Like, everybody knows what the New York Times is.
No, not Harper's.
When I worked at the Hairpin, people would be like, why do you work at, like, a hair accessory site? Everyone knows what the New York Times is. So then they meet you, they learn that you work at the Times, and then they create this, at least in my brain anyway, they create this idea of who you are and who you should be. And again, I'm, like, just some asshole, like, can't spell, and barely knows how to read. So I'm always afraid that people are going to be like, how the fuck did she get a job? Because I already think that. We don't need more people thinking that. So when it comes to being 24, I don't feel 24. I feel like a very sexy 32.
You are a person who comes up with good questions.
Okay.
You had this thing for the Hairpin.
Oh, yeah.
We had this column. We had all these questions.
One big question. Yeah, it's
and I was reading through them, and it was great.
Yeah.
So now I'm just going to ask you all the questions that in one big question you did not actually answer.
Oh, my God. That's most of the questions.
All right.
Okay.
It is most of the questions.
Yeah, let's go.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
You can take as long or as short as you would like. Question one, what do you want people to say about you when you've left the room?
I didn't answer that because I'm of two minds about that. I want people to say that I'm, there's that Zora Neale Hurston anthology. I love myself when I am laughing, but also when I'm looking mean and impressive. And I just want people to think I'm mean and impressive, but I'm such, like, an effusive oversharer. No one's ever going to be afraid of me. So I would love mean and impressive, but, like, what's more likely is that people were like, she was sort of a bitch, but mostly okay.
But that's what you want people to say?
Oh, that's what I think people say. I think I want people to say, that girl was the funniest person I ever met in my life, and I hope she's okay. I think that's what I want.
What makes you feel powerful?
The Jump Off by Lil' Kim. I've been listening to that a lot.
That's like your morning power music?
When I was dressed as Cookie, I'd walk down the street listening to The Jump Off because Lil' Kim is the baddest bitch around.
We're going to put every single one of these cookie pictures on this podcast. They're going to be everywhere.
It makes me feel powerful. Listening to female rappers, eviscerating dumbasses on the internet, and, again, like, having, like, my Instagram comments are lit right now because teens have all found me and they, like, read my shit on the Cosmo Snapchat or whatever, and they're just, like, thanking me. And I feel not powerful in a scary way, but powerful in sort of just like, and I actually did what I set out to do.
Who's the most important person in your life?
Me. Is that a terrible answer?
No.
I didn't hesitate at all.
No.
I'm going to have to talk this one out.
Yeah, talk it out.
With my therapist.
You can just talk it out right now.
So yesterday was my birthday, and I have a lot of anxiety about, like, having celebrations because it feels like I have to quantify my friendships. And I always think that everybody hates me. And people don't hate me. And it was, like, a really nice surprise. And I had a really wonderful time. And so then I was, like, awfully hungover, and I was like trying to make a bargain with God at 2 a.m., being like, I get out of this hangover, I'm going to be a better person. And I realized that I have a lot of really important people who care for me, and it sounds really corny, but like, I didn't know. But that being said, you always got to look out for number one, because you're just not going to be like, okay, this is all like refrigerator magnet rhetoric, but you're not going to be at your best unless you're taking care of yourself. Like, put your oxygen mask on first, you know? That's how I honestly feel.
Thank you, Jasmine.
Thanks, Mike Linsky.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week, Molly Bain. Thanks to all of them. Thanks so much to Jasmine for taking the time and teaching me how to be better at the internet. It's not going to take, but I appreciate her effort. Thanks to our sponsors, Masterclass, The Great Courses, and of course, our dear friends at MailChimp. We'll see you next week.